Right, good morning all. This is Mark 15 that we're going to be reading this. I'm going to be reading this morning verses 1 to 39. And this is quite a dramatic scenes that I'm going to be reading about, which has happened. And I would like very much for you to help me, because I don't want to be the only one up here shouting. So you're going to join me, should you feel comfortable, to shout the same words as I do when we come to verses 13 and 14. The crowd is shouting, "Crucify him!" So please join me saying those words. So chapter 15, verses 1 to 39. Very early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders, teachers of the law, the whole Sanhedrin made their plans. And so they bound Jesus and led him away and handed him over to Pilate. "Are you the king of the Jews?" asked Pilate. "You have said so," Jesus replied. The chief priests accused him of many things. So again, Pilate asked him, "Aren't you going to answer? See how many things they're accusing you of?" But Jesus still made no reply. And Pilate was amazed. Now it was the custom at the festival to release a prisoner whom the people requested. And a man called Barabbas was in prison with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the uprising. The crowd came up and asked Pilate to do for them what he usually did. "Do you want me to release for you, to you the king of the Jews?" asked Pilate. Knowing it was out of self-interest that the chief priests had handed Jesus over to him. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have Pilate release Barabbas instead. "So what shall I do then with the one you call the king of the Jews?" Pilate asked. And they and we shouted, "Crucify him!" "Why? What crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. But they and we shouted all the louder, "Crucify him!" Wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas and he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. The soldiers led Jesus away into the palace, that is the praetorium, and they called together the whole company of soldiers. They put a purple robe on him and then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on him. And they began to call out to him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And again, they struck him on the head with a staff and spit on him. Falling on their knees, they paid homage to him. And when they'd mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put on his own clothes on him. And they led him out to crucify him. A certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. They brought Jesus to the place where called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. And then they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it, and they crucified him. And then, dividing up clothes, they cast lots to see what each would get. And it was 9 in the morning when they crucified him. The written notice of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." They crucified two rebels with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "So you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself." And in the same way, the chief priests and teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. "Oh, he saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. Let this Messiah, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." And those crucified with him also heaped insults on him. At noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. And at 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And when some of those standing near heard this, they said, "Listen, he's calling Elijah." And someone ran, filled a sponge with vinegar, put it on a staff and offered it to Jesus to drink. "Now, leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down," he said. And with a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God."
Thank you very much, Val, for reading for us. As we've said, we are drawing now very close to Easter time. Over the next few days, it will come up in conversation, at work, with your neighbours, family, friends. What are you doing over Easter? Are you going away? What are you going to be up to? And in amongst those conversations, there may well be chances to speak about what Easter means, what it means to you. There'll be all sorts of symbols on display throughout society this week. Bunnies and eggs, which sort of represent new life. And then, of course, the hot cross buns and the cross representing Jesus' death, the death that we've just read about. And so as we go into this week, I want to take some time today to think about the death of Jesus, just why it's so significant. The cross, when you think about it, actually is kind of a funny symbol, isn't it? Particularly for us to have, to be so central in our faith. Christians have the cross right at the center of what we believe, a symbol of death, of execution. You think of other symbols. Muslims have the crescent moon representing God's guidance. Jews have the candles and the light representing life. Hindus have the om representing the noise of creation. You could even think of just Australia. We have that coat of arms. You know how the two animals, the kangaroo and the emu, have both been chosen as two animals that can only move forward, representing progress. But then for Christians, we have an executioner's cross, an instrument of death. Some of us might even be wearing one around our necks today. Why is it that instead of something representing life or creation or progress or help, at the heart of Christianity and at the heart of what Easter is instead a cross, a symbol of death? Why do Christians put this at the center of what we believe? Well, as we look together today at this account that's been read out, I want to show us the answer to these questions, just why this matters so much. There's lots we could think about. It's been a long reading, different parts of the story we could pull out and think about, many questions we could ask. But I just want to pull out for us today three little bits of the story that Mark's given us, and along with those, three reasons why Jesus' death was so significant and is so significant. So here they are, three things. Jesus' death means, number one, that sin is dealt with, the cry. Reason number two, we're going to see that Jesus' death means that relationship can begin. and we're going to see the curtain. And then we're going to see that Jesus' death means God's heart can be known, the confession. We're going to see that Jesus' death means sin is dealt with, relationship can begin, God's heart can be known. And we're going to see the cry, the curtain, and the confession. Let's start by seeing how Jesus' death means that sin is dealt with. Today's account, I don't know if you found it a hard one to listen to, but it is a brutal story. The crowd's in a frenzy. The Roman governor, Pilate, just after a while takes the easy option and hands Jesus over to the crowd. Jesus is mocked. He's taken to this place called Golgotha. And at 9 in the morning, he's put up on that cross. Two rebels next to him on either side. Ultimately, they argue that Jesus was a rebel too. King of the Jews. The Jews weren't meant to have their own king. They were meant to be under the rule of Rome. And the Jewish leaders are there mocking Jesus, telling him, why don't you get yourself down? You know, if you're some kind of hero, then free yourself from this villain's trap. We've seen Jesus' power. We know that he could escape and he could get himself down, but he stays on that cross. And all morning he's there as his life slowly slips away. He was put on the cross at 9. Midday comes and the land goes dark. And then at 3 o'clock, when Jesus has been hanging there for 6 hours, comes the cry. Mark gave it to us in Aramaic, the language Jesus would have spoken. Verse 34, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why does Jesus call out like this? If you've got a Bible in front of you, you can probably see there a footnote showing that Jesus is quoting from the Old Testament. He quotes from a psalm, Psalm 22. That doesn't mean Jesus is feeling these emotions any less, but I think it does show that he knows what is happening and he knows what's going on. Psalm 22 spoke about mocking and it spoke about his clothes being divided. And I think Jesus knows actually that Psalm 22 is ultimately about him. And I think that also shows us that Jesus knows what's going to happen. That psalm, it goes through some of these things and then ends up in triumph. Jesus knows that 3 days after death, he'll rise again. He's already said many times through the book of Mark that that's what's going to happen. So Jesus isn't crying out because he's surprised or because things have gone wrong or gone off the rails. He knows exactly why this is happening. He knows as well that this will end in triumph. But still, I think what he's experiencing in this moment is a real forsakenness. Why have you forsaken me? I think there is a sense in which at this moment, Jesus has been forsaken by the Father on this cross. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that God's wrath, God's right and just anger that he has towards sin and evil in this world has at this moment been turned upon Jesus. You might remember back in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus prayed that the cup would be taken from him. The cup in the Bible tends to represent the cup of God's justice, his wrath ready to be poured out on his enemies or on those who have deserved it from sin and sin and sin over the years. And at this moment, that cup representing justice and wrath was poured onto Jesus. He was forsaken by the Father and the cup was poured on him. And why? Well, so that it didn't have to be poured onto us. I'm going to give you some sort of nerdy, geeky, theological words for what we're talking about here. Some of you would have heard this before. This is what we call penal substitutionary atonement. Penal because a penalty has to be paid. That penalty for sin and for evil in this world. Substitutionary because Jesus paid that penalty as a substitute for us. And atonement, which literally means at one meant, being at one, meaning we've been brought back to be one with God again. God's wrath was keeping a separation. We couldn't be with God. But now that his wrath has been turned aside, atonement has been made. Again, we can come to him. Penal, penalty paid. Substitutionary, paid by Jesus, our substitute. Atonement, meaning that we can be brought back to God. I think it's worth just mentioning what we call that, partly because actually it's good to know that for some this is an idea that's not very well liked. Certainly even in Christian circles and in some churches, people are happy to talk about Jesus' death and they're happy to talk about it as a heroic sacrifice and perhaps a great example for others. It was heroic and it was a great example. It is a great example, but it's also more than that. We also talk about this as a way of thinking about how Jesus on the cross defeated Satan. Satan could rightly accuse us of sin and say to God that we weren't worthy of him. And because of that cross, that accusation is now no longer valid. If you were with us at Christmas time this last year, we spoke about this. We did the Christmas dragon thing. If you weren't with us and you don't know what I'm talking about when I say Christmas dragon, that's okay. Don't worry about it. We had a big blow-up dragon. You kind of had to be there. But all those things can be really helpful, different ways to think about what Jesus has done. But I think this is the bit that some people perhaps don't like so much. They don't like the idea of God having anger, of God having wrath. Even I'm slowly reading through Narnia with my daughter Lucy. If you've read Narnia or seen the movies, you'll remember the Easter-y kind of scene. Aslan the lion goes to his death and is killed in the place of Edmund, who's a traitor. And Narnia's great, and it kind of is angling for that idea of Satan and the accusation. But in Narnia, the one who's angry at Aslan and the one who punishes Aslan is not God. It's the evil character. It's the White Witch. The White Witch is the one who's angry. The White Witch is the one who puts Aslan on what it's called a stone table that he's killed on. But here at the cross, it's not Satan's anger poured out onto Jesus. It's not the evil guys taking Jesus down. It's God himself who forsakes the Son. It's God's wrath poured out onto Jesus. It's God the Father who forsakes God the Son, turns his anger aside and turns it onto him. This, I think, is what can be hard to hear, and I think understandably so. It can be hard to believe. Can the God who made me be an angry God? Can I trust in a God who needed to pour his anger out rather than just perhaps let his anger go and just let it be? And it is a hard picture to think about, but I want to put it like this to you this morning. As we look around at all the evil in this world, the wars that rage and the people trafficking that occurs and the injustice and the selfishness and the hurt being done to others and the violence and the hurt being done to the environment and the exploitation and the chaos and the death. As we look at evil in this world, both now and through history, couldn't we say that it's right that God would be angry? That he's made this world and he cares about it? And this isn't how it should be? Don't you think actually if he said, you know what, don't worry about it, not a big deal. Not to be silly, but wouldn't that actually be a bigger problem? Our God is a God who cares about good, cares about justice, cares about how people are treated, cares about how we treat people, cares about how we live, cares about the hurt we've done. And he made this world. It wasn't meant to be like this. And that means he's ready and right to be doing justice. He's right to be pouring out the cup of his judgment. The problem with all that, of course, is that we know, or I hope we know, that if God is a God of justice, well, we're part of the problem. We all contribute to the sin and brokenness in this world. His justice would mean wrath coming down on us, on all of us. Except for, amazingly, when Jesus was put on that cross and went to his death, that cup, that wrath of God, God's right and proper and good anger, was turned aside and taken onto himself. Now, I wonder how it feels to be hearing about this. It might make us a little bit uncomfortable, and I think it's meant to, actually. It's a wonderful truth, but it's a hard truth, that God has poured out his wrath and taken it onto himself. We see that in the cry. Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, Jesus said. My God, why have you forsaken me? In the cry, we see that sin has been dealt with. But let's keep moving, because secondly, Jesus' death also means that relationship can begin. The curtain. Jesus has called out. Someone comes to give him that final drink on a sponge. And then with another loud cry, Jesus breathes his last and dies. And then verse 38, probably not what you would expect to come right after this. A curtain is torn in two from top to bottom. Perhaps first thought you might think, I hardly think this is time to bother about the drapery. But of course, though it's strange, this is a moment of great significance. The Jewish temple, this was very well known to the people who were in Jerusalem at the time. For us, of course, it feels like a million miles away, and it was a couple of thousand years ago. But the Jewish temple was a very carefully set up building. It had a big outer area where anyone could come, a big outside sort of courtyard. And then inside that, there were walls and gates, and there was a section where only Jewish people could come. And then you keep going inside, there were more walls and more gates, and there was a section where only Jewish men could come. The women couldn't come any further. And then there was a section even within that where only the priests could be, and that's where the altar was. And all that was still outside. And then you go inside the building in the middle of the temple, which was the sanctuary. And of course, it's all getting more and more exclusive as you came more and more deep into the heart of this building. And then behind, inside the sanctuary, there was a curtain. And behind the curtain was what was called the Holy of Holies, a place where only a priest, only one priest could enter. And he could only enter once per year, the most exclusive place of all. This is where the ark representing God's presence was. And the curtain that separated that place from the rest of the sanctuary was a big curtain. We've got curtains on the stage behind me. I don't know how far across that would be. I've got 6 meters or something like that. The curtain separating the Holy of Holies was 10 meters, so you know, probably almost double the length of that curtain. And it was also probably about 10 meters high, so probably quite a bit taller than those curtains would be if we were to open them. This was a very exclusive spot with a big curtain, somewhere you would never dare enter. It makes me think of just kind of the vibe when I think of, okay, what's our modern version of the temple? Perhaps it's the Marian Shops, Westfield Marian. I don't know if you feel this, but I'm a pretty sort of low class man of the people kind of guy. When I go to Marian, if I go in, if I go to perhaps Kmart, I feel pretty much at home. I feel pretty comfortable. Target, it's okay too. A little bit ritzy, but and then I go to Harris Scarfs or something like that, and it's okay. And then I go into Meijer, and people start asking me if I need any help, and it's a bit scary. And then if I go to David Jones, maybe it's even a bit more scary again. And then, of course, there's those really classy, nice stores where I go inside and wonder if I could even afford to be in here. Well, as you would have gone through the sections of the Jewish temple, you would perhaps feel something a little bit like this, only much more so, more and more exclusive, more and more intimidating. And to go into the Holy of Holies itself was unheard of. You know, you wouldn't even dream of ever going there. Unless you were a prospective high priest, and that's might be what you were aiming for. Only one person could go in there once a year. Once they'd gone in, they would never go in again. It took all sorts of rituals and sacrifice and precautions. And really, that was all because of what we heard in point one, that sin problem. God's perfect justice and our sinfulness do not mix well. But now sin has been dealt with. God's wrath has been poured out. And as a great sign of what this means, the temple curtain itself is torn, ripped in two from top to bottom. Mark has been actually telling us quite a bit the last few weeks about the temple. Jesus has been talking about how the temple wouldn't be needed anymore, talking about how the new way to relate to God wouldn't be through a temple, it would be through him. Remember in Mark 13, he spoke about the time that would come about 40 years later when the whole temple itself would be actually destroyed because that's how much it wasn't needed anymore. But here it's just the curtain. The curtain is ripped as if to say suddenly, because sin is dealt with, relationship with God can begin. Now, of course, there is a sense in which before Jesus, the people of God's people in the Old Testament did still have a relationship with God. They sort of did relate to God. But let's not downplay the significance, because now there's no more need for a temple, for tabernacles, for a system of complicated sacrifice. No more need to be intimidated as if the prospect of coming before God is scary or dangerous. The temple curtain has been torn, and anyone who trusts in Jesus and trusts in his sacrifice for our standing before God can now come before God's very throne with no fear. Before God, we're now righteous and can join his family and his people as adopted sons and daughters if we trust in Jesus. We can come before God like a child comes to a loving parent. We can talk to him. We can pray to him anytime about anything, knowing that he hears us, knowing we're in restored relationship with him. But now some of us might say, if there is a God, and well, what if I don't really want a relationship with him? And if it's a question of relationship, why does it have to be on his terms? You know, why do we have to go through all this? Why couldn't he just accept me as I am? And they're good questions, I think, and there are a few things we could say. Ultimately, if we don't want to know God and have a relationship with him, well, he does respect that choice. But also, this isn't just a random person wanting to get to know us. This is about knowing and having relationship with the very one who made us, the very one who made everything. And if he really made you and really made you for relationship, this is about being who you were meant to be. This is about living the way you were meant to live. This is about flourishing and living the best kind of life, living in sync with our Creator, with the one who made us. If I could put it this way, and I realize this is a slightly sensitive thing to talk about, but no parent has children hoping that they won't have anything to do with them. They have children because they want to know and love them. And when there are exceptions to that, I know there are exceptions to that, and there are tragedies and breakdowns of relationship and all sorts of things, but it almost always comes with hurt or pain and sadness on both sides. Being in a relationship with the one who made us, the very one who gave us life, is a good thing. And the other thing to say about this, I think, actually, is before we decide, well, I wouldn't want a relationship with this kind of God, well, we need to now go to our third point and see what God is like at his heart. That's what we're going to see now. We've seen that in Jesus' death, sin is dealt with. We've seen that in Jesus' death, relationship can begin, the cry and the curtain. Point three, in the death of Jesus, we also see that God's heart can be known, the confession. Let's look one more time at our passage. Jesus has cried out and died. The temple curtain has been torn in two. And verse 39, again, I think very surprising what we keep reading here. The centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died and said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." This is an amazing verse. I should say, I was almost going to preach the whole sermon just focusing on this one verse. I think there's so much we could say about it. And there are so many questions, like it's a Roman, right? Like, why is there a Roman ruler, a centurion, a ruler of 100 Roman soldiers? Why is this centurion, who's probably the one who took charge of Jesus' executions, why is this centurion saying, "Surely this is the Son of God"? And what does it mean for a centurion to say this? What's going on in his mind? And what's he even talking about? But rather than think too much about the centurion himself today, I want us to take a little bit of time to think about how significant this is in the context of the book of Mark. Today, by the way, is sort of the end of our time in the book of Mark. We went right through the first half of Mark last year. This year we've gone right through the second half, and we'll hear a little bit more from Mark next weekend over Easter. We looked at this last part of Mark as well, last Easter actually. But I wonder if you remember how the book of Mark began. I'm sure perhaps we don't. If you've got a Bible, it's actually probably worth flipping just back to the start of Mark. Mark chapter 1, verse 1. Mark gives this little introduction to his book. He writes, "This is the beginning of the good news about Jesus." And then he gives Jesus two titles, the Messiah and the Son of God. Mark 1, verse 1. And then the book of Mark has been divided into two halves that follow those two titles. Act 1 has been all about Jesus the Messiah. Was all about Jesus the Messiah. We saw Jesus as king, performing miracles, healings, calming storms, all leading up to that climax in the middle of the book where Peter recognizes that Jesus is in fact the Messiah. And then part 2 of the book, Act 2 that we've been looking at this year, we've seen Jesus heading to Jerusalem, heading to the cross. And just as the first half of Mark ended with a dramatic recognition of Jesus as the Messiah, here the second part of the book again ends dramatically, with this time Jesus recognized at his death and recognized as the Son of God. The Messiah, part 1, the Son of God, part 2. And what I think is especially amazing about this is that of all the places you would expect Jesus to be recognized as God's Son, it's so strange that it's right here, the very moment that he's died. And I think of recognizing people, I wonder if you know that feeling of seeing someone and then trying to place exactly where you know them from, but you're not quite sure. You sort of recognize them, but you're trying to work out who they are. I was swimming at the aquatic center with my daughter Eleanor the other week, and Eleanor loves diving down water slides without any regard for her own safety. And there was another dad there too with his daughter. And he looked slightly familiar. I couldn't quite place him. And obviously I didn't look too closely. He doesn't have a shirt on. I don't want to sort of ogle or anything like that. But a couple of days later, I turned on my TV and I saw this guy on my TV with us, this time with a suit and tie. And I realized he was one of the reporters from the news. I'm sure you know that feeling of sometimes you know someone relatively well, but out of context, it's hard to recognize them, hard to put two and two together. With Jesus, what's really surprising is that you would think that the time would be most obvious for recognizing Jesus as the Son of God would be all sorts of other times through the book of Mark. Oh, he healed the guy who couldn't walk. I know what. He must be God's son, I reckon. Oh, he calmed the storm. Look at that power. He must be the Son of God. Look at him. Oh, he fed 5,000 people. I reckon he's the Son of God. He taught with amazing authority. I think he's the Son of God. He talked about forgiving sins. He talks about forgiving sins. I reckon he must be God, God's son. I think we are meant to pick up on those things, by the way. But of all the places that Mark records Jesus being recognized as God and God's son for the very first time, this is the one, right at the end of the story, right after Jesus has died. Of all the places, rather than looking powerful, this is probably where he looks least impressive. He's hanging, nailed to a cross, stripped naked, bleeding, dying. And yet this is the place where the centurion goes, I know where I know you from. You're the Son of God. It's so strange, isn't it? And yet the answer to the problem of why this is the moment that Jesus is recognized in this way, I think, is actually fairly simple. You see, we've spoken today about God being a just God and having anger, wrath. We know that God's a God of power and might and holiness, of sovereignty and of great knowledge. We know all those things about God. But at least in the book of Mark, I think the answer is there is no place we see who God is more clearly than in his death, in his loving, sacrificial death for others. Was Jesus powerful? Yes. Is Jesus just? Yes. Is Jesus an incredible teacher? Yes. But at the very heart of who God is, the moment he's ultimately revealed to be God's son, God himself is right here at the cross. There's no place where we see more clearly than this who Jesus is and who God is. It means at the very center of who God is, at his very heart, is a love, loving, sacrificial compassion for his people. We've asked today whether we'd want to have a relationship with this God, and we'd ask why we might want to have a relationship with him. And maybe thinking of a God who has wrath and anger makes that even harder to think about, but see who God is at his very heart. This is the God who so loved the world that he sent his one and only Son. This is the God who's so full of love that he came himself, poured his anger onto himself, took the punishment for sins onto himself, also that we would not have to bear it. That's how much he loves us. That's how much he wants what's best for us. He doesn't want to manipulate us or control us or use us in a negative sort of way. He wants what's best for us. And he knows that we're our best selves, the most joyful, when we know him and live in sync with him and live for whom we were made for. And for that, he was willing to give up everything. I think another remarkable thing about this idea is that if it's the cross where we see Jesus most clearly, if it's the cross where we see what God's very heart is like, is that it means to be selfless and loving isn't an unnatural or strange thing for God to do. You could tell the story of Jesus like this, and sometimes we probably do tell it like this, and it's not really too wrong, but it could be told that God was so mighty and powerful and amazing and wonderful, and therefore it's so strange that he would come down and give himself up. It's so out of character. Almost as if we were to hear that Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, maybe even though he's the Prime Minister, maybe a story could come out that, guess what? He was spotted in the toilets each morning, cleaning the toilets out before Parliament. It's amazing that someone so powerful would stoop so low. But actually, if it's sacrifice where we see most clearly who God is, then actually, maybe this sounds heretical, but it's more like God is the toilet cleaner. Of course he would clean the toilets. That's what he does. Of course God would sacrifice for the sake of others. Loving, sacrificial, selfless sacrifice is who he is. It was his love and care for others that meant he created the world in the first place. It was love and care for others that meant he persisted and made great promises of restoration, even though we didn't live his way. And the good news of the cross is that God's love and care for others has been shown here more clearly than anywhere else. This is the God who would come and would die for us. And can I say that means actually being selfless, making sacrifices for others, putting others before ourselves, is actually right at the core of who we should be. When we put others first, when we give things up, when we serve our church family, when we serve others in our community, we're actually being divine. I think we can say that actually it's the most godlike thing we can do. Live for the sake of others. So I wonder, how might we live for the sake of others and live like Jesus? Perhaps in our church, perhaps in our workplaces this week, perhaps in your family life, in our communities. God at his very heart is loving, selfless, and the place we see him most clearly is the place of his death for our sake. And when we live for others, well, that means we live like him. I hope we can see why the cross is so central in our Christian faith. This little picture of a criminal's execution device tells us so much. On that cross, Jesus cried out. Tells us that sin, the just wrath of God and at the brokenness and evil in this world has been dealt with, turned aside, turned onto him. The curtain it was torn in two. In Jesus' death, we've been invited into relationship with the one who made us. And the confession, the cross shows us who this God is. Nowhere is he more clearly revealed. He's a God of love, a God who can be trusted. So will you trust this God? Will you come into relationship with the one who made you? Will you come and get to know this one who is at his core is full of loving selflessness? Will you live like this God? Will you live for the sake of others? And will you tell of this God? Easter does give us a chance, doesn't it, to speak about why this matters, why the cross matters. Of course, we can talk about the cross all year round, and I hope we do that as we chat to people and do life with people. But we've seen today that actually even the centurion, the very one who oversaw the death of Jesus, had his life turned around and came to see who Jesus really was at this moment of the cross. Now that we've come through Mark and we've seen the cross as well, if we speak to people about Jesus and share with them what the cross is about, well, perhaps like the centurion, they will come to see that he really is the Son of God as well. Two questions on the screen as we take a minute to reflect. If God is at his heart is full of love, what do you think that means for how he sees you? And who might you tell about Jesus and the meaning of the cross in the weeks ahead? After we've thought about that for a moment, Lauren will come up and tell us about what's next.